Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
How did it come about?
Let's have a bit of history.
It is not black and white, is it?
That raises big questions.
There are repercussions around the world.
It's a hugely complicated picture.
The official narrative is somewhat different.
For a greater understanding of the stories affecting our lives, search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Bernadette Keogh, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday, May the 21st, these are our main stories. Greece drops charges against 9 men accused over a migrant boat disaster, while the EU is accused of funding operations by North African governments to dump migrants in the desert. Also, crowds turn out in Iran for the first funeral procession for the late President Raisi. Also in this podcast, medics in Israel say Palestinian detainees are kept shackled and in nappies. OpenAI earns the wrath of a Hollywood A-lister. And
all the tourists cross the street and they don't seem to care about the cars at all. It's dangerous. And they leave litter and cigarette butts everywhere.
Why the quest for the perfect Insta is causing irritation in Japan. We start with two stories concerning the treatment of migrants from Africa to Europe. Every year, thousands of people leave their homes across the African continent in an effort to make their way across the Mediterranean. Last June, an overcrowded fishing boat that had set off from Libya sank off the coast of Greece. 600 people died. Mohammed's cousin was one of them.
He wanted to be a doctor like me. And even now his friends were telling me, you're the doctor he was telling us about. You have a choice. That's what I told them. You either die slowly in Syria or go and try your luck and die fast if you're lucky.
Even before the trial began, there had been question marks over whether it would be fair. The BBC had been told by some survivors they'd been ordered by the Greek Coast Guard to frame the men. I spoke to our correspondent Nick Beek outside the court in Kalamata.
Pretty dramatic scenes actually at the courthouse, and there were lots of protesters outside here, and they cheered when the news filtered through that these three judges had thrown out this case. The reason for that is that they had been looking at an application by the defence, who were arguing that because this boat sank in international waters, there was no legal basis for this trial to be held in Greece. And what's happened is that the judges have agreed with that. So you've got a position where for the last 11 months, these 9 Egyptian men have been held in custody in Greece. They've been protesting their innocence. As you say, 6 survivors told us previously that they believed these men were innocent, that they were framed, and that the Greek Coast Guard had urged other survivors to give evidence against them, something the Greek Coast Guard has consistently denied. So there was all this controversy around the case, and now it's been dismissed, and the men, ultimately, whether it's today or tomorrow, it seems they'll be freed.
And the BBC's been following this case, hasn't it, very closely?
Yeah, that's right. We arrived here in Kalamata on the 14th of June last year. That was the day that the boat sank. And immediately there were big question marks about what had actually gone on. The Greek Coast Guard had said that this boat was travelling at a steady speed towards Italy and it was safe and there was no need to rescue it. But survivors started to say very quickly that that simply wasn't true, that for hours they watched what was happening. And then ultimately the Greek Coast Guard, survivors alleged, launched this sort of last-minute botched effort to tow the boat, causing it to capsize, and we know up to 600 people have died in this situation. So the accusations right from the start. And, you know, in the here and now, these 9 Egyptian men, certainly they've been found not guilty. There's no case to answer. But I think there are some quite troubling questions that remain around the role of the Greek Coast Guard. We know a Greek naval court is examining this at the moment behind the scenes, but certainly a lot of human rights groups are quite worried that we'll never really get to the bottom of what happened here.
Well, as you say, radically different accounts. Do you think there could be recriminations?
Well, certainly the Greek government has been backing the Coast Guard, the Greek Prime Minister last year when asked about the allegations that we'd found. He said that smugglers really are in people's focus here. They should be the people who are culpable for what happens. They make great amounts of money from this trade in human misery, and said that people should be supporting and thanking the Greek Coast Guard for what they do. So it's a case, I think, which has got a lot of attention in Greece, but internationally too. And in terms of whether there's any lasting legacy of this, it's not clear at this point.
Nick Beek. On the same sorry theme, the risks people are willing to take and the price money pay for the dream of a better life in Europe, a group of leading international media outlets, including The Washington Post, Le Monde and El País, have accused North African governments of dumping migrants in the desert with the assistance of funding from the European Union. The newsroom's Richard Hamilton has been following the story and told me more about the allegations.
They've recorded harrowing testimony from sub-Saharan migrants who said they were intercepted in the Mediterranean by the coast guards, taken then overland by pickup trucks or buses around 600 kilometres, then dumped in border areas in the Sahara Desert and told to walk across the border into Algeria, Niger, other countries, where they are dying from heat stroke, dehydration. And they say it's a clandestine operation, but it has a silent partner, which is the European Union. Between 2015 and 2021, the EU sent $400 million to Morocco, Tunisia and Mauritania for a migration fund, which was to foster economic growth and stem migration. Now, they funded projects which are sometimes difficult to track. There's a lack of transparency. And the EU funds, they say, have been used for buying equipment like pickup trucks, as well as training security services. And there are allegations that Spanish security forces reviewed lists of migrants, photographed them before they were put on these trucks and deported.
So why are they doing all this to these migrants?
Well, as we know, the issue of migration is a massive problem, and that's why the far right in Europe seems to be on the rise. And last year, for example, the European Union recorded 380,000 or so irregular border arrivals. That figure keeps increasing. And the North African countries feel that they're really doing Europe's dirty work. So a French academic quoted in the Washington Post says, "The fact is the European states do not want to be the ones to have dirty hands. They do not want to be considered responsible for the violation of human rights. So they are subcontracting these violations to third-party states, but really they're responsible." And then one contractor said, "Basically, we want to make life difficult for the migrants so that if we keep dumping them in the desert, the third time they'll give up and go home."
Is there any response from the North African countries or the EU?
Yes, as you might expect, there have been denials. So the Interior Ministry in Morocco has denied allegations of racial profiling, saying they're baseless. They say migrants are only relocated to protect them from trafficking networks. They said that the European support for them was minimal and that they had to pay most of the cost of deporting people. Similarly, Tunisia, its foreign ministry, has insisted it upholds migrants' rights and only expels them voluntarily. Similar statements from Mauritania. And the European Union has denied sponsoring the mistreatment or deportation of migrants.
Richard Hamilton. Medical workers in Israel have told the BBC that Palestinian detainees from Gaza are routinely kept shackled to hospital beds, blindfolded, sometimes naked, and forced to wear nappies, a practice one doctor said amounted to torture. In response, the Israeli army said detainees were only handcuffed when security demanded it, and that nappies were only used for those who had undergone medical procedures. The BBC's Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson reports.
Sufyan Abu Saleh returned to Gaza an injured man. A taxi driver from Khan Yunis, newly released from Israeli military detention, he limped down the hallway of a Gaza hospital. The knotted trouser leg of his grey prison tracksuit dangling where his left leg should be.
My leg got infected and turned blue and soft as a sponge. After 7 days, they took me to the military hospital, dragging and beating me on the way there, hitting my injured leg. They operated twice to clean the wound, but it didn't work. Afterwards, they took me to a public hospital, where the doctor gave me two options, my leg or my life. How am I supposed to feel after having two legs for my whole life and then losing one? Every now and then, I cry.
Around him, his children wept silently as Sufyan showed the BBC the stitches sewn across his knee. The return of their father, soured by sadness. Neither Israel's army nor health ministry responded to these specific allegations about Sufyan's treatment. But there's growing concern over the medical care of Gazan detainees in Israel. Footage from Israeli television shows detainees from Gaza held in military prisons, classed as unlawful combatants even before interrogation. Doctors say they are kept shackled and blindfolded, including during hospital treatment. Allegations have centered on a new field hospital at the State Teman military base.
I think that it's most important that physicians like me, as we treat people, I could not care less what the prisoner is doing there or not.
Yoel Donchin, a senior medic and anesthesiologist at the hospital, says patients are kept blindfolded and in nappies, with all four limbs handcuffed to the bed.
The army, they create the patient to be dependent 100% on you like a baby. You are cuffed, you are with diaper, you need the water, you need everything. It's dehumanization of them.
The army told us that the need to handcuff detainees in the medical facility was examined individually and daily, and that cuffing was done only when the security risk required it. Diapers or nappies, it said, were only for those patients with limited movement. But Dr. Donchin told us that these measures were applied to all patients without assessment, even those who couldn't walk.
If they can't stand on their legs, why are they shackled?
I can't answer this. This is stupid.
Treating Gazan captives on military sites was meant to resolve doctors' ethical dilemmas, but those dilemmas remain. The moment our hospital at State Teman closes, Dr. Donchin told me, we'll celebrate.
Lucy Williamson. The British government has set out its plans to compensate those affected by a scandal that saw doctors, the National Health Service and successive governments try to cover up the fact that tens of thousands of people contracted hepatitis C and HIV after they were given contaminated blood or blood products. John Glenn from the Governing Conservatives told the House of Commons about the scheme.
Those who have been infected or affected as a result of this scandal will receive compensation. To be crystal clear, if you have been directly or indirectly infected by NHS blood, blood products, or tissue contaminated with HIV or hepatitis C, or have developed a chronic infection from blood contaminated with hepatitis B, you will be eligible to claim compensation under the scheme.
I heard more from our UK affairs correspondent, Rob Watson.
It's 30,000 people over a 20-year period where people were given blood products which led to severe health problems, in some case death, in the case of 3,000, but perhaps most grievously, to just compound it all, that for decades the government covered up, the health service covered up, doctors covered up what they knew and the risks that had been known all along.
And will this compensation package satisfy the campaigners, do you think?
I mean, given what they've been through for the last 20 years, I think they're bound to be rather sceptical, but they were pleased with the report. They feel as though the truth has finally come out, and I guess they're going to be pleased that the scheme, certainly in the way it's been defined in the last hour or so, it seems to be rather wide-ranging and generous and could well end up paying out over $12 billion. But I guess the key thing to sort of step back from this is that the whole way in which this has unfolded has sort of shaken the sort of faith in the system, by what I mean, the sort of the government, politicians, civil service, the health service, doctors, shaken the faith that people have that in the system in Britain, that it's somehow there for ordinary people. And this, of course, is not the first scandal, Bernadette. It's come on the top of others like the post office. So a really sort of, you know, profound moment for reflection for the British state.
Yes, as you say, it follows the post office scandal, which has been described as one of Britain's worst miscarriages of justice. Is it perhaps a sort of sign that Britain's somehow broken, Rob?
Well, I mean, it will certainly feed into that. I mean, what you have a lot in Britain at the moment, opinion polling, that anecdotal evidence suggests that somehow people think the state, it's just not working, whether it's transportation, whether it's health, whether it's government, wherever people look, they just feel that something about Britain is broken. And certainly this will contribute to that, particularly if you contrast it internationally, where this problem with infected blood happened, you know, in lots and lots of countries. But Britain has taken longer than any other to sort of get round to dealing with it.
Rob Watson. The new AI-powered chatbot, ChatGPT-4, has removed one of its voice options after users found it bore an uncanny resemblance to the American actress Scarlett Johansson. OpenAI denied that it was in any way connected with the role she played in the 2013 film Her. Here's a snippet of what the new chatbot sounded like.
Hey, ChatGPT, I'm Mark. How are you?
Oh, Mark. I'm doing great. Thanks for asking. How about you?
I'm on stage right now. I'm doing a live demo, and frankly, I'm feeling a little bit nervous.
Oh, you're doing a live demo right now? That's awesome. Just take a deep breath.
Our technology correspondent Zoe Kleinman told us more about what the actress has been saying.
Scarlett Johansson says she's shocked and angered to hear that the voice you just heard of a new tool called GPT-4o sounds so much like her. She says she'd been approached by Sam Altman, who's the boss of OpenAI, and asked if she would be the voice, and she turned it down. And then she says 2 days before they launched it, they contacted her agent again and turned it down again. Now, when the tool was first unveiled, Sam Altman tweeted one word, which was the word her. Now, you may be familiar with a film from 2013 called Her, in which Scarlett Johansson plays an AI assistant that the male lead, Joaquin Phoenix, falls in love with. So he clearly did see that there was some sort of coincidental connection there.
This is such a good example, isn't it, of exactly what so many creatives are worried about. You know, the idea of AI mimicking your art, your work, your livelihood, and then perhaps ultimately replacing you. Now, we've got an AI safety summit in South Korea, and this is going to be one of the subjects that's discussed there. But it is really worrying to people who say not only does AI mimic it well, but it's also arguably cheaper to use than the real deal, isn't it? It will be interesting to see what comes out of it. But definitely, there's been a change in mood. When I went there in November, it was all about, you know, the big doomsday existential threats that might be posed from AI. And that seems to have changed track now and become, you know, let's talk about job losses. Let's talk about bias. Let's talk about these issues that are really more likely to hit people's lives sooner, I think, than the sort of doomsday Terminator scenario.
Zoe Kleinman. Still to come, a passenger dies as a long-haul flight hits severe turbulence on its way from London to Singapore. This time yesterday, we were reporting confirmation of the death of the Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi in a helicopter crash on Sunday. Today, the funeral ceremonies have begun. Thousands of people in the city of Tabriz swarmed the truck carrying the coffins of Mr. Raisi and others who died in the accident. Some waved Iranian flags, others held portraits of the late leader. I asked the BBC Persian's special correspondent, Kazra Nadji, to talk me through what was happening as Iran begins 5 days of mourning.
It started today with this informal funeral in Tabriz. Of course, Tabriz is the capital of East Azerbaijan in northwest Iran, about 100 kilometers south of where the helicopter came down. What we saw today, a truck drove among the crowd with the coffins of the president and the foreign minister and others, six others who were killed. We are expecting a formal funeral tomorrow in Tehran, presided over by Iran's supreme leader. 5 days of mourning, tomorrow national holiday, and the Iranian regime is very keen to project stability, continuity, and support. They want many people to come out to these ceremonies to show that people have rallied around the government and the regime. Of course, you see in Tabriz, for example, about 10,000 people, probably more. These are the people who are supporters of the hardliners in Iran. There are many people who are not. We're talking about probably 10-15% of the population who support the hardliners and the government. So the rest of the population do not appear in these crowds, and they are on the side for the moment. And from what we see, reports and social media, there is quite a different sort of emotion amongst those people.
And condolences have come in from all over the world. What can we read into those as Iran prepares for a forthcoming election?
I think from the Iranian point of view, they are encouraging in a sense that Iran is pretty isolated. And if you see various people, various organizations, the UN, the EU, heads of states expressing condolences, it's heartwarming for them in a sense that, you know, they think that they may not be as isolated as they thought or as they are. But nevertheless, I don't think this anything is going to change. This regime is going to go on. There will be no changes in policy. And we are waiting for the next election, which is going to be held on the 28th of June.
Kasra Naji. Shiva Marbobi is one person who's definitely not joining the public mourning for Mr. Raisi. As a former child prisoner herself, she has first-hand experience of the impact of his policies and is now a spokeswoman for the campaign to free political prisoners in Iran. She's been talking to Sana Safi.
He issued basically arrest warrant, kidnapping millions of people, including 13 years old, 12 years old, because I was myself in prison once when I was 12 and once I was 16 years old. Many of my prison mates were actually executed in the summer of 1988. 36 years ago, in the summer of 1988, he was the member of a death committee. He ordered the execution of more than 5,000 political prisoners only in 3 weeks. So he is called a butcher of Tehran for the right reason. And also in the Women Life Freedom Movement and protests, he was in charge and he was emphasizing and reinforcing the morality police to kill women, to suppress them. So as you can see, consistency, Raisi been suppressing, been impacting the life of people, millions of people, those families who lost their kids in the 1988 massacre, they are still, after 36 years, looking for the grave of their loved one. And they're still threatened up to this day. I'm really sad that this is not shown on TV and on the news, that people were having fireworks last night, because they were happy that this murderer has died.
You mentioned that you went to jail twice. Can you tell us why you were jailed?
The first time when I was 12, we were demonstrating for reopening our school. And the second time I was in demonstration as when I was 16 years old. I think it's important when you hear the name of Raisi, that is like you hear the name of Hitler for us. And it's really interesting that yesterday we heard that International Criminal Court prosecutors is seeking arrest for Netanyahu and Hamas leader. Islamic regime, if someone like Raisi actually created Hezbollah, funding Hamas. But unfortunately, Raisi, to the end of his life, he He was invited. He was accepted. How can a murderer who committed crime against humanity for more than 40 years can be welcomed in the UN and other countries? And that's what people want. They want whoever replaced Raisi. It really doesn't matter. Regime in Iran is a system, and they're all united in suppressing people, especially suppressing LGBTQ, women, and whoever are defying them, basically.
Shiva Marbobi. She was talking to Sana Safi. A 73-year-old British man has been killed and several other people injured on a Singapore Airlines flight from London that was hit by severe turbulence. The Singapore-bound plane was diverted to Bangkok, from where our Southeast Asia editor Jonathan Head is following developments.
We know the plane landed here in Bangkok. It's at the airport now. There were a lot of ambulances sent in to deal with those who've been injured. Everyone on board who was hurt, well, everyone on board will be off the plane by now, and all those who are injured will be treated. We have had confirmed one fatality. There were 211 passengers and 18 crew members on board. It was a Boeing 777 on a normal scheduled flight. It's a long flight from London to Singapore, and the turbulence was obviously very unexpected, and I presume it must have occurred somewhere. We don't know the exact location, but somewhere not too far from Bangkok, because that was obviously the first airport they were able to land at in order to deal with the injured. But as things stand at the moment, we're simply awaiting more details of the state of the passengers who were injured and possibly a little more detail about exactly what happened. As far as we know, and from what reports we've been given, this was unexpected, very sudden, severe turbulence that affected the aircraft. And those passengers who were injured, it's likely they were probably not wearing seatbelts. That's often the case in flights.
Jonathan Head. Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, which published leaked military documents online, has been told he can appeal against an extradition request from the United States. He was granted permission by the High Court in London to appeal against the order that he be sent to the US to stand trial for leaking military secrets in 2010 and 2011. The US argues that the WikiLeaks files, which disclosed information about the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, endangered lives. Monday's decision means that Mr. Assange will now be able to challenge US assurances over how any trial would be conducted. His wife, Stella, gave us her reaction to the ruling.
It was a relief, but this is just a temporary reprieve. Julian is being prosecuted under the 1917 Espionage Act. The thing about this piece of legislation is that it has no public interest defense. He cannot say what the documents contained, why, what the calculation was. And of course, these documents revealed war crimes, evidence of torture, assassination squads, the gravest of international state-sponsored crimes. And of course, this case, therefore, should never have been brought. The case yesterday in court turned on the United States' position that because he's an Australian national and because the alleged activities, the alleged crimes of possessing and communicating, publishing, took place outside of the United States, that he would not have access to the First Amendment when he's on trial in the United States. This is a constitutional protection that Americans would be able to invoke, but because he's a foreigner and he was abroad, then he would not have access to constitutional protections. In the past 5 months, we've had two hearings in which, if he had lost, he would have been immediately processed for extradition, potentially within hours or a day. So it's been a very, very stressful ride. And all we have now, as I said, is a temporary reprieve, a permission from the High Court to be able to bring a full appeal in relation to the First Amendment, his access to the First Amendment.
Stella Assange, the wife of the WikiLeaks founder. One of Japan's most popular photo spots is being blocked by authorities frustrated at tourists disregarding local rules and wreaking havoc for residents. A big black barrier has been installed to obscure views of Mount Fuji. Residents of Fujikawa Guchiko accuse mainly foreign tourists of dropping rubbish and parking illegally as they search for the perfect photo. Our correspondent Shaima Khalil went to Mount Fuji and sent us this report.
This is as Japanese as a view can get. I am looking at
a convenience store, or a kombini as it's known here, the famous Lawson, and in the background is the majestic Mount Fuji, or Fujisan, the ice-capped volcano. And around me are many, many tourists. I can't even begin to count them. And all of them are aiming their cameras, their phones, at this view. Chances are you've probably seen this on your TikTok or Instagram. This has become the social media money shot for millions of visitors who make the trip here. But it's also been the bane of the existence of so many locals who've complained and complained about tourists behaving badly.
All the tourists cross the street and they don't seem to care about the cars at all. It's dangerous. And they leave litter and cigarette butts everywhere.
Kazuhiko Iwama is 65 years old and has lived in the town of Fujikawa Guchiko all his life. His balcony opens up to a view of the beautiful snowy summit and of all the tourists clamoring for the perfect snap. As a desperate measure, the local authorities are building a barrier to block the view. But Mr. Iwama's not convinced it will make a difference.
I hope we won't have to deal with more traffic and the litter problems. But I am worried about tourists stepping out onto the street to take pictures when the black screen goes up.
Raisa Lorente travelled from Australia and has just taken the coveted photo.
I think it's upsetting for the tourists that's going to come here because of those reasons. I think it's a bit sad. We're lucky to be here before that happens.
Well, the crowd is really picking up now in this spot. And the local security has been warning people, blowing his whistle, shouting at times, telling people to get off the road, to cross the street properly, because there have been so many complaints about tourists blocking traffic.
You can take a picture of Mount Fuji from many places in this area. But as Coralie Niecki, a tourist from Germany, tells me, the prospect of going viral has become a big pull for this particular spot.
If I didn't have social media, I wouldn't come here. I wouldn't even know that it existed, this place, like this Lawson exists with the picture. And because like so many people posted it online, and maybe just because one person came here, took the picture, and it went viral, everyone came here.
For the first time ever, Japan has had more than 3 million visitors 2 months in a row, thanks to a weak yen and the lifting of post-pandemic restrictions. But it's a tough balance to strike for a country with a struggling economy. Boosting businesses while protecting residents and popular locations from over-tourism.
Shaima Khalil. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Daniel Fox and the producer was Mark Duff. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Bernadette Keogh. Until next time, goodbye.